The first series of 2022 is brought to you with the kind support of Herd Capital, a Chicago-based asset manager that invests in public equities in the technology, media, telecommunications, financial, and industrial sectors. The firm was founded in 2011 and manages assets via a long-short fund and a long-only fund.
How did an old Soviet-style computer plant the seeds to travel thousands of miles across the world to pursue a PhD? And how is factor investing evolving to meet modern needs? Let's find out next. I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Vitaly Kolesnik, who is a partner and senior member of the investment team in Research Affiliates, a Newport Beach headquartered investment firm. Vitaly is based in London. He has focused his career in equity-based research and has a PhD in economics. He has written extensively in academic journals and has received various industry awards for his content. He is originally from Belarus. Welcome, Vitaly. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with your background and career journey. Can you talk us through your time growing up, what you studied, and how you came to enter the world of investing?
Well, as you said, I'm originally from Belarus. So as a kid, I was interested in mathematics-related things. My parents got me a computer when I was pretty young. They were doctors, and they obviously didn't know what the hell they were doing. So it was some Soviet-made computer. But nevertheless, that kind of helped me learn some coding skills. So after going to school and going to university in Belarus, I went to apply to PhD programs in the United States, and I went to UCLA. And UCLA economics and finance programs are probably one of the best in the world. So for example, Guido Imbens, who just got a Nobel Prize, was one of the professors who was teaching me in my first year. Now, it's not like all of my teachers were Nobel laureates, but nevertheless, it was a great experience. And then afterwards, at grad school, I was very interested in finance and investments. And right out of school, I joined Research Affiliates, which was at the time kind of getting from a stage of startup to becoming a serious enterprise. And so since 2006, I've been with Research Affiliates, slowly growing through the ranks. For a long time at Research Affiliates, I was head of equity research. And 4 years back, I moved to London. And my role here is head of research, which means that I basically continued doing what I was doing in Newport Beach, collaborating with many of the great people in Research Affiliates while being closer to kind of ground zero of some of the evolution of factor investing, for example, with smart beta, ESG-related topics. And that move was intended as a effort for Research Affiliates to be closer to the conversation that is happening here in Europe in all of these areas.
Well, we'll dig in a little bit to that a little bit later on, because I think that's a fascinating area. Just before that, though, just going back to that childhood in Belarus and then applying to the US, was that a typical path or was that somewhat unusual at the time?
I think it was unusual at the time, and it is still unusual. So as a teenager, it's fun to go and explore and go visit places. And so I had a few friends who were like-minded, pretty serious in studies, but were just equally adventurous. And so basically a buddy of mine and I, we got to seriously study all the opportunities, and we figured out that, well, actually, it's a very great way to kickstart a career because applying to PhD program in the States, if you can get in, is actually gives you a free education. In fact, university supports you. You have to do like research assistant or teaching assistant work for the university, but then you don't have to pay anything, and then the university pays a stipend, which is a fantastic way to get great education. And so once we learned, it felt almost like it sounds almost too good to be true. But later, as we explored, is it real to get into PhD programs? It turned out to be, yeah, it is real. And so we applied, and both my buddy and I got into decent schools. So I got to UCLA, that friend of mine got to UNC, University of North Carolina, and now he's also a partner in a litigation consulting firm working out of DC, for example. So basically, within my small circle, it was not untypical, but for an average Belarusian, it wasn't typical at all.
Very interesting. Well, let's go to that time you spent studying either for your PhD or working as a lecturer, because you've also generated a prolific amount of articles. So let's look at the research and your time in academia. What area of research excites you most at the moment?
Well, where I think I have a decent research skill is in empirical equity research, so asset pricing and similar related areas. And that's what excites me. So I'm very interested in empirical studies related to different anomalies in equities. I'm equally interested in looking into evolution of the business side. So for example, smart beta, I said in the beginning that that's one of the focuses of my firm, Research Affiliates. And for example, I view largely smart beta as, well, it's partly finance, but it's partly business evolution, where some of the known strategies from before are offered in transparent, simple, and low-cost strategies. And so looking at the business side and investor decision side is equally interesting to me. Now, you also mentioned my work as a lecturer. So I've taught courses at a few schools at SDSU, San Diego State University. More recently, I lectured at UCLA, and kind of coming back to alma mater, and now not as a PhD student, but as a lecturer. And that has been an interesting experience on its own. In a sense, it's less related probably to the academic work in terms of writing articles, but it's more related to me personally to be able to communicate some of the learnings I've done. But I think I also get quite a bit from teaching in terms of my personal skills. So for example, before starting teaching, I felt, and I still feel like my presentation skills are not perfect, but before they were horrific. And so by doing lecturing, by getting in front of students and teaching every week for 3 hours was a great experience, where by doing it, you lose a lot of the fear of the audience. You start understanding better how to prepare the speeches, how to prepare the lectures, how to prepare slides. And it teaches also how to effectively communicate to the audiences of different skills, because it's one of the hardest things is to unlearn what you know and to be able to communicate effectively. So, for example, what do I mean by this? Once you know something, it's kind of very intuitive in your mind, all the connections and logical steps. And teaching helps to break these logical steps into elements that are likely to be understood by somebody who doesn't know all the background. So I found overall the teaching experience quite helpful to myself personally in terms of growing my skills.
Very interesting. And now moving to the investment industry itself, and you mentioned factor investing. Where do you think we are in terms of the adoption, perhaps, of factor investing? Do you think we've passed the peak? We're prior to the peak? We're before the peak? Do you think this is an area that's going to see increased sophistication?
So factor investing, a couple of years back in 2016, we've written an article, How Can Smart Beta Go Horribly Wrong, with Rob Arnaud back and John West. And in the article, we're wording that, well, smart beta and factor investing today are probably often used interchangeably. So that's why I'm talking about smart beta in this context. And the warnings in the article were that factor investing was gaining huge popularity, but we pointed out that the area is over-marketing the benefits and under-explains the risks of factor investing. That's one. And second, we were observing that some of the factors were getting expensive, and that expensiveness was driven by a strong ride in performance. So when something is growing, it's quite tempting for investors to pile money into that area, but then investing into something that is expensive is prone to making subsequent performance worse. And so today, a few years later, what we see is that many investors have gotten burned with factor investing, and to a point where it has gone horribly wrong for some of the investors. Now, do I think that factor investing is a good idea? I do. I think that there are factors like value, for example, or low beta, or some definitions of quality, which can generate better performance for investors. Now, is it going to work in all periods in any given 3-year period of time? No, it won't. Factor investing is prone to have sharp drawdowns and prolonged periods of underperformance. That is just a part of factor investing. And that's probably part of the reason why these factors are generating returns to begin with. So that's the part of it. And so investors need to understand that part to be able to benefit from factor investing in the long run. So coming back to your question, are we at the peak, bottom, or where are we in the adoption cycle? I think in 2016, the area was overhyped and overmarketed. I think today, investor performance did not meet their expectations, which kind of tarnished the area. But at the same time, this area has strong benefits, meaning low cost, transparency, and exposure to factors that do work in the long run. So I think what it means for the adoption of factor investing, I think these underlying commercial benefits are still there and they're going to continue being there. And just like with the adoption of indexing, which took decades, I think adoption of factor investing will also take decades. But also I think that at the current stage, many of the factors are actually cheap. So small cap or value specifically looks very cheap relative to the history. And so going forward, factor investing is very likely to generate better returns. And so when investors will have experience with factor investing over a full cycle of performance, that's when the popularity of the area will start rebounding.
And what are some of the new areas that you're working on research? And you mentioned wanting to be close to Europe. What's some of the innovation that's happening in Europe that perhaps is not happening in the US right now?
I think ESG-related attention. Europe is maybe 2 steps ahead of the United States. Well, probably a year and a half ago, it was 2 steps. Now, maybe a step ahead today. US is starting to catch up. So ESG is very important focus for what we're looking at. Now, ESG is important area because it brings in an element of investments outside of just pure risk return analysis. Now, ESG can also be related for risk return analysis, and we can talk about it separately, but it has a whole other dimension, which is focusing on the world outside of just pure investment outcomes. And so that's quite important, and I think that that will continue growing. In fact, I strongly believe that it will continue growing. Now, also, there are some challenges in the area. So specifically, in our observation, a lot of the work in ESG is based on beliefs or kind of not very well thought through analysis. And so where it can benefit from is a rigorous empirical analysis of the things that are going on. So for example, last year, I've collaborated with 2 gentlemen from Augsburg University, Marco Wilkins and Jona Zink, on an article where we looked at the carbon emissions data and we evaluated the quality of the data. So why is it important? Well, carbon emissions is becoming a focal point for ESG-related elements in many European countries and outside. And reasonably so, because climate change is a very important topic. Now, at the same time, all the investor outcomes are going to be a function of the data that they have. And so as a result, what we did is we looked at carbon emissions data that we can get from data providers today. And interestingly, much of the data historically, and the situation is changing, but even today, much of the data is voluntarily disclosed. So reporting carbon emissions is today, and the situation is changing in terms of regulation, but it has been voluntary. And what it means is about half of the market cap, we get the data from the companies themselves, which has its own problems, but that's the best data we have. And then for about half, data providers evaluate the data. And so when somebody else evaluates the data, they don't have as much visibility into the emissions as the company itself does. And so as a result, there is quite a bit of noise in these estimates. And so we, for example, one thing that we did was compare the reported versus the estimated data. And what we found was that the estimated data are about 2.5 times less efficient in identifying the worst emitters compared to the reported data. That's a pretty big gap. And that gap suggests that we should target mandatory reporting. That companies, it's to a degree a little bit of a crazy situation where companies are emitting pollutions, they're polluting, they're consuming the public good, and yet they don't even have to report on their emissions. To a degree, that's a crazy situation. And so I think that there are all reasons for us to change that. That's one element. For example, the other element that we found out was that forward-looking data, and then forward-looking data, by the way, in terms of emissions, is extremely important because for investors, it's important to know not only who is emitting CO2 gases today and other greenhouse gases today, but who will be emitting them in the future. And yet, when we look at the forward-looking scores from multiple data providers, we find that they have very little forecasting power for the future changes in emissions. And when I'm saying very little, the T-stats are not statistically significant and R-squares are at zero and don't move when we include these predictors. So pretty much no predictability. So what it means is that much of the forward-looking emissions today are based on just cheap talk done by the company. And so it has many implications, for example, that we think that investors should probably abstain from using the forward-looking data before they see hard evidence that it is indeed predictive of the future changes. Also, we think that the estimates should be based on investments into different areas rather than based on the communiques and plans and other very non-binding communication from the firms.
And I'm just wondering, does that mean that in this area, there is more of a danger of greenwashing, given what you've said about some of the lack of predictive effect of some of the predicted data?
Well, the first title of the article was Green Data or Greenwashing? Do the carbon emission data help investors mitigate climate change? So I think that that title itself answers like those conclusions that we reach are pointing in the direction that if we use a subpar data, in the end, even if intention is good, and even if we want to use the best we can, there is an element of greenwashing in the outcomes.
Do you see that in the US that the ESG adoption is going to occur on a lagged basis to Europe, or do you think that the pace of adoption is still likely to be slower?
In the US, it's partly political in the sense that US just generally is probably more to the right compared to the European political spectrum. And that can imply that there is more skepticism about non-financial consideration in terms of investment outcomes. So in the investment world, so specifically the Department of Labor in the United States just a few years ago reinstated their warning. I don't remember exactly what legality that communication had, but it essentially implied that investors shouldn't be considering ESG-related aspects unless they have a strong belief that it will improve their risk-return profile. And so that doesn't sound to me like a strong incentive. It sounds to me like introducing a risk factor into investor decision process of trying to bring in ESG, especially if it turns out to be underperforming ex post. Investors could be fined liable for bad decision. So that type of regulation and stances on different regulatory bodies implies that, so before that traverses, the ESG adoption will be slower. Now, having said that, more lately with the Democratic administration, that is more likely to change. And so the actions this year have shown that they're paying quite a bit more attention to climate change. And so I think that that means that U.S. are moving in the same direction, just at a slower pace. But I think that also they will inevitably catch up, partly also because of the demographic shifts. I think the younger cohort of voters and investors care more about social outcomes, and probably younger voters are more European-like in that regard. So from that perspective, I think eventually US will catch up with Europe in that regard.
And just my last question on ESG is obviously the social part around gender equity. Perhaps if we turn the lens on our own industry, the scorecard may not be an A+. What are your thoughts on the diversity of the investment industry from your vantage point?
So I think the diversity, you're absolutely right. I think once we get into a typical finance firm, very often we see very little diversity. And diversity is very important. So we think actually that diversity is important, not just from social point of view, but also from the financial point of view. So I mentioned in the beginning that ESG connection to risk and return can be mixed. So for example, if we were to take random studies of relationship between risk and return, many measures are more likely to point in the opposite direction, where good ESG can lead to bad performance. Now, when it comes to diversity, and here I mean diversity more broadly, diversity can be a very good indicator of a good governance for a company. So if a company tends to promote only very specific types of individuals, it can imply that this company doesn't have good governance in place and that they can be close to alternative points of view. And so companies with more diversity can actually signal good governance. And so from looking at ES and G elements, governance, in our opinion, is one of the elements that is the most related to the good investment outcomes for firms. So from that point of view, for example, we at Research Affiliates had launched a RAFI ESG, Research Affiliates Fundamental Index with ESG element, where one of the elements is looking at diversity of the board and the management of the companies. And we think that the high diversity is more likely to generate better investment outcomes.
That's interesting. It'd be very interesting to track performance of that. I know there have been some indices that have been shown to have better outcomes. So we'll certainly keep an eye on that. Just let's go back to your personal story now. Throughout your journey, your career journey, your personal journey, have there been any people that have had a particular influence on you, and in what way?
Oh, many people. I think I've been extremely lucky in my collaborators on research projects. So I've had wonderful co-authors, Jason Hsu, Rob Arnott, Kim Harvey, Yuhani Lin Ma, and others. I've learned a ton from them in terms of doing research, communicating research, creating an efficient collaboration to get to a good project outcome, where we start from the idea and track this research project all the way to publications and then later communication of it more broadly to the investment world. So I think I've been extremely lucky at the people I've met and have collaborated with through my professional career. Now, of course, also my professors at school, I've mentioned Guido Imbens, for example, but also Andrew Atkinson and a number of other professors at my grad school, for example. They were fantastic teachers. So what did I learn from them? Now, of course, from all of them, I've learned a lot of things. So along the dimensions that I mentioned, but also I find that finding good collaborators and building multi-year effective collaborations is extremely important for long-run success for me, for example. I think that it's an important skill and an important thing to do.
It's interesting how in academia it's referred to as collaborators. And I suppose in the workplace, we think of mentors or team players, but I like that concept.
Looking back also at some of your career journey, has there been any setbacks or any challenges that you've learned any lessons from?
Setbacks and challenges. So I think as a junior, and by junior, I mean, so I joined company with the PhD, but by for all extensive purposes, I was a junior member of the staff. And I think it took me a while to gain confidence and to work to the full potential. Now, having said that, I think that that's kind of inevitable. So as a junior person joining a firm, you should be expecting a lot of hard work and slow rising, kind of slow accumulation of skills and learning both communication skills, learning how to build relationships, building a reputation. It all takes time. And so obviously everyone has mistakes in terms of, for example, so empirical research, from time to time, there are mistakes. And it's good to learn from those mistakes to avoid them in the future. So, for example, a few years back internally, I wrote kind of like a funny email to the team, like 10 different ways of integrating a look-ahead bias into one simulation. And it was a funny little email, but I think that people found it helpful because there are some unintuitive ways, for example, to make mistakes in empirical work. And it takes some experience to learn that.
And when you look back at maybe some of those interactions with the collaborators you mentioned or some of the mentors that you've dealt with in your life, was there any key piece of advice that you received or any creed or motto that you live by?
Well, Rob Arnott, who I've collaborated and keep on collaborating extensively, has a motto of "these two shall pass." I think that's from the Bible, right? I might be wrong. But I find it a very good motto, both in terms of the professional career, personal growth, and investment world and investment decisions. So in terms of personal and professional growth, so it's good to take time perspective. So for example, you talked about mistakes. Mistakes happen. And it's important when that happens, when mistakes happen, it's good to take a time perspective and get back and say, well, will people be remembering that in 3 months, 6 months, or 2 years from now? And if they will, what can I learn from that? And that can help, that type of motto and that type of perspective can help better think of what can I learn from that? How can I better avoid it? Instead of being just moody and depressed about the mistakes somebody makes.
And my last question is whether you have any advice for your younger self, maybe for that young student looking at exploring courses in the US. Now that you're established in your career, is there anything that you know now that you wish you had known then?
Outside of clairvoyance type of advice, I think if I paid a little bit more attention to linear algebra in my first year at university in Belarus, I'd have to spend a little bit less time later. But I think that's a little bit of a silly advice. I guess probably, I think kind of looking at my career and looking at my upbringing, I think probably the bigger lesson is not from me, but from my parents. And so my parents, I mentioned that they were quite deliberate in providing learning experiences in the sense that I mentioned that my father, for example, bought for my brother and myself a computer when we were like 10 and 12. And my father didn't know much about computers and being a doctor, so he had nothing to do with the area. But when we had early on exposure to computer, and by the way, that was still Soviet Union, so it was a very clunky Soviet-made computer. It was breaking every other year. But it was a very fun tool for us to learn some coding early on, and that coding skill turned out quite helpful. And then later, when I was in my high school years, my parents, for example, hired a math professor tutor for 2 years. And that tutor was a little bit, it was a very good tutor in the sense that that tutor was quite pushing. He was a math professor himself, so the learning sessions with him would be very intensive. And then later on, he'd give a huge homework where it would be almost like a full-time job just to go through that homework. And going over that training for like 2 years in high school was building good problem-solving skills coming from mathematics, but also brought some work skills and work ethics probably for the future foundation. So basically, I think that my parents, for example, in that sense, knowingly or unknowingly did a, like with those type of money spending, probably had done one of the best investments that they could have done into my upbringing. So I'm very grateful for that. And so I don't know how helpful it is. It's not an advice for me, but that's probably a more of an advice for me as a parent now, for example, and how I'm kind of thinking about my kids.
Well, it's definitely a leap into the unknown. I'm sure back then buying that computer was a bit of a leap, but certainly it paid off. So thank you very much, Vitaly. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you here, some fascinating insights on factor investing and just where we are in the course of that journey. It's really helped us to, I think, clear away some of the noise surrounding that area. So thank you for coming here and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.